This week, we continue on with the stories that we find in the book of 1 Samuel. We started the book last week, and we went through chapter 7. The stories that we found in those first seven chapters revolve around Samuel, a man that God raised up during the time of the judges. We have seen over the past few weeks how the time of judges was somewhat of a, at times, somewhat lawless, somewhat unfaithful, and there was no central leadership. There was supposed to be a central leadership, and that is that God was to be their king, but the people lost faith and turned away from God many times. And in fact, even the high priest, Eli, his family, his sons who would succeed him were very wicked. And not only were the people unfaithful, but so were the spiritual leaders. So God raised up Samuel and brought him into a place to be an example, to be a leader, to be a prophet, to be a judge for the people, okay, to guide the people back to Yahweh, to back to Him. And we saw the stories there, and we saw that Samuel really became recognized as the leader as a result of a major event that happened. We saw in 1 Samuel chapter 4, there's a major loss that they had at Ebenezer, verse 10 to 11. Says, the Philistines fought and the Israelites were defeated and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. And on top of that, the Ark of God was captured and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So there was a major defeat by the Philistines. 30,000 here, 4,000 a few days earlier, 34,000 Israelites soldiers lost their life to the Philistines. The Philistines were just an unmatched force for the Israelites. And so there's this major defeat, but on top of that, the high priest's sons died. They were killed in this battle. Okay? Not a major deal because they were not very good high priest's sons. They were not very good for the next generation, but what they brought into battle with them was the Ark of the Covenant. And the Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines. The Ark was recognized by the Israelites to be, to symbolize the presence of God. In fact, that's why they brought it into the battle, because they had lost this first battle and lost 4,000 men, and they brought the Ark, sent for the Ark, Hophni and Phinehas brought it, so that they would therefore, they thought, have God with them in this battle. But that wasn't the reason why God wasn't with them in the battle. God was not with them in the battle because they had rejected Him, and they were unfaithful. And because they had not turned to Him and had not inquired of God, and God had not sent them. So we have this major loss that happens here in chapter 4. The Israelites, we see, are dejected. For instance, in verse 22, well, that same day of the battle, Hophni and Phinehas died. When word got back to Eli that the battle had been lost, thousands of people had been killed, even his sons had been killed, that upset Eli, but what really upset him was when he heard that the Ark of the Covenant had been captured. It upset him so much he fell backwards on his chair, broke his neck, and died. So he died on that same day. Also on that same day, his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was pregnant, and she went into labor with all the commotion, and she had a son. And then verse 22, it says, she said, the glory has departed. Well, verse 21, she named the boy Ichabod. Say, which Ichabod means no glory, saying the glory has departed from Israel because the capture of the Ark of God and the death of her father-in-law and her husband. She said, the glory has departed from Israel for the Ark of God has been captured. And her sentiments that are expressed there were the sentiments of the rest of the Israelites. They've lost the Ark. The Philistines have captured the Ark. To them, they've lost God. Okay, the Ark represented God, and the Philistines have captured God. God has left them. The God that has protected them all this time, the God that had given them these victories and had given them this promised land, He's gone. Okay, so they were very dejected, very upset about that. Now, we had some interesting stories in chapter 5. The Philistines took that Ark, set it, took it to the temple of Dagon. Dagon was their chief god, and put the Ark in front of the statue of Dagon, symbolizing that Dagon has conquered and is captured and is more powerful than Yahweh, the God of the Israelites. And we see in chapter 5 After they did that, the following morning when they rose, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. Kind of like he was bowing down, but he was laying down on the ground in front of the ark. His head and his hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. And we see that verse 6, the Lord's hand was heavy upon the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation upon them and afflicted them with tumors. And your footnote might also say, and rats appeared in the land, and death and destruction were throughout the city. So when the ark was brought to Ashdod and put in front of Dagon, Dagon fell over. Well, first he fell over, then the next day he fell over again, and that's what we just read there, is that when he fell over the second time, his head and his hands broke off, okay, showing God's superiority over Dagon. Okay, even though the ark was not God, the ark represented God, represented Yahweh, which even that ark, just with its representation of Yahweh, is more powerful than a made-up god, Dagon. But we also see that tumors popped up on the people of Ashdod, where the ark was brought, including the leaders as well as the regular people. So the people of Ashdod tried to get rid of it, and they sent it on to Gath. Okay, and then the same thing happened there. Tumors popped up on people, rats and disease went throughout the city. So the people in Gath decided, well, we got to get rid of this. So they sent it on to Ekron, the next Philistine town. The people of Ekron said, no way, we don't want it. We see what happens when it comes here. So they decided, we've got to do something. We've got to appease the God of the Israelites. We don't care about the Israelites, but the God of the Israelites we need to appease. So they returned the ark. We see in verse 11, they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and said, send the ark of the God of Israel away. Let it go back to its own place, or it'll kill us and our people. For death had filled the city with panic. God's hand was very heavy on it. So they decided to send it back. And they did send it back. They returned the ark to Israel. They put it on a new cart pulled by a couple of cows. We talked about that story last week. And they let the cart just go wherever the cows would take it, seeing if the cows would go where they thought, and if they did, then that would be proof that Israelites' God Yahweh was in this. And sure enough, it did. And it headed on, and it went to Beth Shemesh, which is the nearby Israelite city. And then it says in chapter 6, verse 14, that the cart came to the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. And there it stopped beside a large rock. The people chopped up the wood of the cart and sacrificed the cows as a burnt offering to Yahweh. So the people at Beth Shemesh received this ark. They were thrilled about it, and they sacrificed the cows as an offering in praise and thanksgiving to God for returning the ark. That ark didn't stay in Beth Shemesh very long, and there's a reason. Going on, verse 19. God struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh, putting 70 of them to death because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. So their curiosity got the better of them. The people mourned because of the heavy blow that Yahweh had dealt them. So now they were afraid of the ark. And the men of Beth Shemesh asked, who can stand in the presence of Yahweh, this holy God? To whom will this ark go up from here? We've got to send it on somewhere. Then they sent messengers to the people of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of Yahweh. Come down and take it to your place. Okay. So the men of Kiriath-Jearim did that, and they took it there. So the ark is now back. But the people are upset, okay, because of what had happened. And it's clear that God was not behind them. God was not on their side. And verse 2 of chapter 7 says that it was a long time, 20 years in all, that the ark remained at Kiriath-Jearim, and all the people of Israel mourned and sought after the Lord. And what we see here is the same thing that we see in the cycles in the book of Judges, that people would turn away from God, turn unfaithful and worship the Baals and the Asherahs and the various Canaanite gods around and not worship God. God would then allow some trouble to come upon them, and eventually, through that trouble, they would realize the cause of their trouble, and they would turn back to God, and they would repent, they would turn away from the gods, the foreign gods that they were worshiping, they would turn back to Yahweh. Yahweh would then raise up a judge who who would save them from that trouble, and then they would remain faithful, at least during the time of that judge. Then they would forget about what God had done for them in future generations and turn just as evil as before, actually even more evil. And we have that same cycle happening here. So God has allowed the Philistines to become a problem to the Israelites because of their unfaithfulness. And so now we see in verse 2 that the people of Israel mourned and sought after Yahweh. That's what he's looking for. And then we have Samuel. Samuel comes into the picture. And remember, Samuel's name means ask of God. So now they've returned to Yahweh and they're asking of God, what must we do to be saved here? And Samuel said to the whole house of Israel, if you're returning to Yahweh with all your hearts, then get rid of the foreign gods and the Asherahs and commit yourself to Yahweh and serve him only. And then he will deliver you out of the hands of the Philistines. So the Israelites put away their Baals and the Asherahs, and they served Yahweh only. So Samuel tells them, God wants you to come back to him. God wants you to stop worshiping these gods that are no gods at all. God wants you to worship him and serve him and be faithful to him. And if you do that, then he will come and rescue you from the Philistines. So they do that. They get rid of their idols and turn and start following Yahweh again. So then the next step in the cycle is that God rescues them. And how does that happen? Going on. Verse 5, Samuel said, assemble all of Israel at Mizpah, and I will intercede with Yahweh for you. So they assembled at Mizpah, and on that day they fasted, and there they confessed. In verse 6, we've sinned against Yahweh. And Samuel was leader of Israel at Mizpah. So we see him coming into his own as a leader here. When the Philistines heard that Israel had assembled at Mizpah, the rulers of the Philistines came up to attack them. Hey, we've got sitting ducks here. And when the Israelites heard of it, they were afraid because of the Philistines. They said to Samuel, don't stop crying out to Yahweh our God for us, that he may rescue us from the hands of the Philistines. So, Samuel, pray harder. Keep praying, okay? Keep sacrificing. Then Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it up as a whole burnt offering to Yahweh. He cried out to Yahweh on Israel's behalf, and Yahweh answered him. While Samuel was sacrificing the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to engage Israel in battle. But that day, Yahweh thundered with loud thunder against the Philistines and threw them into such a panic that they were routed before the Israelites. So God brought them victory. How did they conquer this huge army, this army that was much more powerful than the Israelites? Because God got involved. So going on then, we see that the men of Israel rushed out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines, slaughtering them. Okay, then Samuel set up a standing stone and named it Ebenezer to be a reminder that God had helped them here. And the Philistines were subdued, verse 13, and did not invade Israel territory again. Okay, so God saved them from the Philistines. In fact, it says throughout Samuel's lifetime, the hand of Yahweh was against the Philistines. The towns from Ekron to Gath that the Philistines had captured from Israel were restored to her. And Israel delivered the neighboring territory from the power of the Philistines. And there was peace between Israel and the Amorites. So God did bring peace. God did rescue them from the Philistines. They regained some of the land that they had before. It stopped the attacks from the Philistines and brought peace. Okay. And then who was leader? How long did Samuel continue as judge? Samuel continued as judge over Israel all the days of his life. From year to year, he went on a circuit from Bethel to Gilgal to Mizpah, judging Israel in all those places. But he always went back to Ramah, where his home was, and there he also judged Israel, and he built an altar there to Yahweh. So all his life. And so we see that Samuel played the role not only of a prophet, but also as a judge. And that made that cycle that we've seen before of the judges here. All right, so Samuel is leading Israel as judge. How does Samuel, as he gets older, how does he try to continue his leadership even beyond death? Chapter 8. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. Now, in looking at the judges that we've looked at so far in the book of Judges, and looking at the leaders that we've seen that God has had for the Israelites, is leadership passed on from one generation to the next? So far, we haven't seen that. When God's raised up judges, God has raised up judges. It hasn't been from succession. But here we see that Samuel appoints his sons as judges. If you look back in Judges chapter 2, verse 16, it's just one example of how people came to be judges. It says, "Then Yahweh raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders." So people became judges because God called them to be judges. Okay? They were not appointed by men. They didn't decide that they wanted to be a judge. And they didn't inherit the role. But Samuel was trying to change that and give that responsibility and leadership to his sons. Now, what had been the opinion about rulers during the time of the judges? Well, if we look back at the story of Gideon, after Gideon saves Israel, we see that in chapter 8, verse 22. The Israelites said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you, your son, and your grandson, because you saved us out of the hand of Midian." But Gideon told them, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. Yahweh will rule over you." So they believed that they had a king already, and that king was God. And that part is great as long as they obey that king, as long as they're faithful to that king. They ran into trouble when they weren't. We then saw in chapter 9, the following chapter in Judges, that after Gideon died, one of his sons decided, you know, that whole thing about being king, I like that idea, and I want to be king. And so he went to one of the cities, and he tried to set himself up as king, and the people accepted that. And we'll just read verses 22 and 23. "After Abimelech had governed Israel 3 years, God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem," which was the city that he was ruling there, "who acted treacherously against Abimelech." So there was animosity, there was trouble. Abimelech and the people turned against each other and ended up killing each other, and there were all sorts of problems from that. Okay? So that's their history to this point about having a central leader other than God. Other than, you know, they had Moses at the beginning, then they had Joshua. But since Joshua, it's just been a confederacy of tribes led by the elders within the tribes, but no central leader other than God. So, what happens then? With this history of God as our king, but then taking a look at the powerful enemies that they've had to fight and had to deal with, especially the Philistines, the people come up to him and ask him for something. We'll go on. Verse 3. "Samuel's sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. So, all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, 'You're old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now, appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have.' So things have been pretty good under you, Samuel. You've brought us back to faithfulness. We have peace here. The Philistines are not attacking us. So we like having your leadership. But you know, your sons are not like you." Sounds a little bit like the family that preceded Samuel, right? Eli and his sons. Eli was faithful, but his sons Hophni and Phinehas were not. And they were wicked men. Now we have that Samuel's sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain. They accepted bribes. They perverted justice. Not what a judge of Israel is called to do. Okay, not the relationship with God. Because a judge of Israel is to be one who is in a faithful relationship with God and leads the people, not only politically, but also spiritually. And so they go to Samuel and say, "We want this leadership, but it's not your sons. So give us a king. Give us a king." How did Samuel respond to the thought that his sons weren't fit as judges? Verse 6. "But when they said, 'Give us a king to lead us,' this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to Yahweh." Okay, so he may be partly upset about his sons, but he's really upset about the idea of setting up a king, because God is king. Why do you want a king? And so he turns to God and says, God, what do I do? How does God respond to Samuel's feelings of rejection here? And Yahweh told him, listen to all that the people are saying to you. It's not you that they've rejected, but they've rejected me as their king. As they've done from the day I brought them out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods. So they're doing to you. Now, listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do. Okay? So God says, Samuel, don't be upset because they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. Okay? They've been doing this for years. I'm used to it. Okay? But they're rejecting me. So listen to what they have to say, but make sure that they realize what they're asking for. Make sure they realize that if they get a king, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that comes with it. So, how did Samuel respond to the people? Going on, verse 10. Samuel told all the words of Yahweh to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, now this is what the king who will reign over you will do. He'll take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses. And they'll run in front of his chariots. Some he'll assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow the ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He'll take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He'll take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He'll take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourself will become his slaves. When that day comes, you'll cry out for relief from the king that you've chosen, but Yahweh's not going to answer you in that day. So he paints this bleak picture of what a king's going to do with them. That if they get a king, there's some baggage that comes with that, and that king's going to tax you, the king's going to put you into service, he's going to conscript you and your sons and your children, and you're going to regret the day that you picked up a king. So he paints this picture. So, how did they respond, and why was it that they really wanted a king? But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we'll be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles. So now the real thing comes out. This is why they wanted a king. Because then we'll be like all the other nations. They've got these big, powerful kings, and they can fight our battles and go out and lead us. We don't have that. We need a strong king like that. Well, but they do have that. They had that with God. They had the best king, a king that guaranteed victory all the time in battle, a king that guaranteed peace as long as they followed that king, as long as they were obedient, as long as they were faithful to that king. Now they're asking for a human king. Well, the same story is going to go. Things are going to be okay up to the level of ability of that king and the righteousness of that king, as long as they're faithful to that king. But as soon as they're unfaithful to that king, they're going to have trouble too. Okay? But here they're asking to give up the best king they could have, God, and settle for a human king. And they want that. So Samuel gave him the warnings and told him what the king would do and the downsides of having a king. But they said, we want a king anyway. That's their response. Did God oppose appointing a king? We see that Samuel didn't like it. What about God? Going on, verse 21. When Samuel heard all that the people said, he repeated it before Yahweh. Yahweh answered, listen to him and give him a king. Well, then Samuel said to the men of Israel, okay, everybody go home. Everybody go back to his town. So God said, listen to him, give him a king. So God did not oppose the appointing of the king. Why not? Well, or why would he? Does God oppose government? You know, you take a look at the leaders that we have, you take a look at the leaders that have led the world until now. Is he against government? Is there, give to Caesar what is Caesar and God what is God's? Is there an animosity there? let's turn to Romans chapter 13. Paul says, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what's right, and he'll commend you. For he is God's servant to do you good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of the possible punishment, but also because of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. So Paul paints a pretty clear picture that God does not oppose governments. In fact, God sets them up. Governments are in existence because God has allowed them to be in existence. God has instituted them. They are authority. The authorities are there working for God, whether they realize it or not. Okay? They are God's servants, and we're to respect them, we're to follow them, we're to submit to them. Okay? We're to do what they ask of us, pay our taxes, those kind of things. Now, that again was from Paul. Now, Paul was... he was a Roman citizen. So you say, okay, well, you know, he would support the government that he's known forever, for all his life. What about someone who wasn't a Roman citizen? What about Peter, for instance? What did he have to say? Turn to 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 13 and 14. Peter says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted under men, whether to the king as a supreme authority, or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. So he says basically the same thing that Paul does. Those authorities are put in place, they're instituted by God, and so submit yourselves to them. Well, sometimes that might be easier than other times. Have you ever found times where you disagree with those in authority? What are we supposed to do then? How do we respond when we disagree with those in authority? Paul mentions that in 1 Timothy chapter 2. He says, I urge then, first of all, that requests, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. This is good, and it pleases God our Savior, who wants all men to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth. Okay? So what is Paul telling Timothy here? If you disagree with your rulers, pray for them. Okay? Always pray, whether you agree or disagree, pray for your rulers. Ask God for peace. Ask God to work through that ruler. Thank God for them. Thank God for the rulers. Okay? So, the request for a king is not in opposition to... God's not opposed to that. He's not surprised by the request either here. Okay, so we then, that brings us through chapter 8. Now we'll see Saul, the very first king of Israel. And we first see his story. What's the first thing we learn about Saul? Starting in chapter 9. There was a Benjamite, a man of standing, okay, a well-to-do man, whose name was Kish. Okay, he was the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechoroth, the son of Aphia of Benjamin. So there's a man who was from the tribe of Benjamin. His name was Kish, and he was well-to-do. He had a son named Saul, an impressive young man without equal among the Israelites. He was a head taller than all the others. So that's what we first learn about Saul, is that he's from the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, his dad is very well-to-do. He's in a well-to-do family. He's an impressive young man. He's big and tall. He's a head and shoulders taller than anyone else around. So when you're thinking about a king, that's kind of what you think of. Someone big, strong, mighty, handsome, good-looking, someone who's well-to-do, well-off, and impressive kind of person. And Saul was that kind of person. He looks like he could be a king. Okay. Now, we pick up on Saul. He's wandering around the tribal areas of Ephraim and Benjamin. Why is that? Verse 3, now the donkeys belonging to Saul's father Kish were lost. And Kish said to his son Saul, take one of the servants with you and go and look for the donkeys. So he passed through the hill country of Ephraim and through the area around Shalisha, but they did not find them. They went on to the district of Shalim, but the donkeys were not there. Then he passed through the territory of Benjamin, but he couldn't find them. So why was he wandering around? He was looking for his dad's donkeys. His father's donkeys had wandered off, and so he went off looking for them. But he couldn't find them. He went all over the place. He spent days, he spent 3 days looking for these donkeys and could not find them. So eventually, it's been 3 days. They've pretty well eaten all the food that they brought with them. It's been quite a while. You know, Saul's a little concerned. Well, Dad might be wondering about me. So let's go home. But then there's one last idea of hope that Saul's servant suggests here. So we'll go on. I'll start at verse 5. When they reached the district of Zuph, Saul said to the servant who was with him, come, let's go back or my father will stop thinking about the donkeys and start worrying about us. But the servant replied, look, in this town there's a man of God. He's very highly respected and everything he says comes true. Let's go there now. Perhaps he'll tell us what way to take. Okay. So he's got the idea of going and checking with Samuel about, hey, where's the donkey? Now Saul hears this suggestion and he's kind of wondering, well, how are we going to get this guy to if he's a seer, how are we going to get him to tell us where the donkeys are? So he says in verse 7, he says, if we go, what are we going to give this man? The food in our sacks is gone. We have no gift to take to the man of God. What do we have? The servant answered him again, look, hey, I've got a quarter of a shekel of silver. I'll give this to the man of God so that he'll tell us which way to take. Well, a quarter of a shekel of silver is a tenth of an ounce. Okay, not worth much at all, just a buck or two. So, you know, what kind of gift is that going to be to the seer? But nonetheless, they, how does Saul respond? Verse 10, good, Saul said to the servant, come, let's go. So they set out for the town where the man of God was. They went up to the town, and as they were entering it, there was Samuel coming toward them on his way to the high place. Now, they don't know what Samuel looks like. They just know that the seer's there, the prophet of the man of God is there in the town. So they don't necessarily know who Samuel is, okay, when they see him here. But Samuel happens to be coming out just as they're going in. And so we see that Samuel was that man of God. How was Saul unknowingly fulfilling a prophecy that God had made to Samuel? Going on, verse 15. Now the day before Saul came, Yahweh had revealed this to Samuel. About this time tomorrow, I'll send to you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him as leader over my people Israel. He will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. I've looked upon my people, for their cry has reached me. So when Samuel caught sight of Saul, Yahweh said to him, this is the man that I spoke to you about. He will govern my people. Okay? So God had told Samuel that he was bringing the next king to Samuel. Samuel didn't know Saul. And when Saul comes walking up into town, as Samuel's walking out of town, God says, that's him. This is the guy right here. Okay? So Samuel and Saul meet. And it's interesting that Samuel answers Saul's questions even before Saul gets a chance to ask the questions. Going on. Saul approached Samuel in the gateway and asked, would you please tell me where the seer's house is? I'm the seer, Samuel replied. Go up ahead of me to the high place, for today you are going to eat with me. And in the morning I'll let you go and I'll tell you all that's in your heart. As for the donkeys that you lost 3 days ago, don't worry about them. They've been found. And to whom is all the desire of Israel turned, if not to you and to all your father's family? So Samuel says some things. You know, Saul goes up to this guy and says, hey, where does the seer live around here? We're looking for the seer. And the answer he gets is totally unexpected, very confusing, very whatever. He happens to be talking to the seer. And the seer says, I'm the seer, and you're going to have dinner with me. So go up to the high place. I'll meet you there. We'll have dinner. And then tomorrow morning, I'll answer whatever questions you might have. But by the way, don't worry about the donkeys. Saul's going, donkeys? You know about the donkeys? Okay. And you sure are the seer. And Samuel says, don't worry about the donkeys. They've been found. And by the way, who else is greater in all of Israel than you that all Israel will look to? And Saul's going, what is he talking about? And how does he respond to the idea that he was chosen for something special? Verse 21, Saul answered, but am I not a Benjamite from the smallest tribe of Israel? And is not my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me? How's Saul's response here? His response is just like the same response that Gideon gave when the angel of God came and called him to go and rescue Israel from the Midianites. Okay? Saul was humble. I'm a nobody. What are you saying this to me for? I don't understand. Okay? I'm the least of the least. So, but he's the one that God had chosen. We then have a story about the meal, and Samuel had said to the cook to put aside some meat for someone that he'd invited, and that happened to be Saul, even though Samuel didn't know who it was at the time when he had told the cook that. And so they came in, there were about 30 people there, and Saul dined with Samuel that day. After they came down from the high place of the town, Samuel talked with Saul on the roof of his house, and then that next morning they rose about daybreak, and Samuel called to Saul on the roof, get ready, and I'll send you on your way. So Saul got packed up, he got ready, and he and Samuel went outside together. As they were going down to the edge of the town, Samuel said to Saul, tell the servant to go on ahead of us. And the servant did so. But you stay here a while so that I may give you a message from God. Okay. And then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on Saul's head and kissed him, saying, has not Yahweh anointed you leader over his inheritance? How did Saul respond to this? Okay. Only Samuel's there with him. The servant's not there witnessing this. Nobody else is there to witness this. So Samuel is telling Saul that he is the king, that he's going to lead the people of Israel. But nobody else knows this yet. But Samuel anoints him and says that God has chosen him for this. Saul's got to be confused here, and Saul's got to be wondering, what is going on? What is this really true? What's the deal? So how would Saul know for sure that this was real, that he really was chosen by God to be the leader of Israel? Well, Samuel answers that before Saul gets a chance to ask this. Samuel says, when you leave me today, you will meet two men near Rachel's tomb at Zelzah on the border of Benjamin. They'll say to you, the donkeys you set out to look for have been found. And now your father stopped thinking about them and is worried about you. He's asking, what shall I do about my son? Okay. So when he sees that, that's one thing that he'll see, is that he'll see two men at Zelzah, and they'll tell him about the donkeys are found and that his father's worried now. Okay, so when he sees that happen, that would be proof for him. But he goes on, he says, and then you'll go on from there until you reach the great tree of Tabor. Three men going up to God at Bethel will meet you there. One will be carrying three young goats, another three loaves of bread, and another a skin of wine. They'll greet you and offer you two loaves of bread, which you will accept from them. So there's another sign for him. And then he goes on, after that, you'll go to Gibeah of God, where there's a Philistine outpost. And as you approach the town, you'll meet a procession of prophets coming down from the high place with lyres, tambourines, flutes, and harps being played before them. And they'll be prophesying. The Spirit of Yahweh will come upon you in power, and you will prophesy with them. And you will be changed into a different person. So that will be a third sign. You're going to meet some prophets at Gibeah, and you're going to join them, and you're going to prophesy alongside them. Okay? And then, once all this happens, what is Saul to do? Once he realizes that, yes, God has chosen him to be the king of Israel. Verse 7. Once these signs are fulfilled, then do whatever your hand finds to do, for God is with you. And then come down ahead of me to Gilgal, and I will surely come down to you to sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, but you must wait 7 days until I come to you and tell you what you're to do. Okay, so he says, once these signs have happened, then God be with you. Then you be king. Do whatever your hand leads you to do, because God's going to direct you. God's going to lead you. And then one other thing is I'll meet you next at Gilgal. Okay, so we'll meet there, but when you go there, wait for 7 days before I show up, and then when I get there, I'll give some offerings, and then I'll tell you what to do. Okay? So he gives them these instructions, and then Saul goes on his way. And do things happen like Saul said, or like Samuel said? Verse 9, as Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart, and all these signs were fulfilled that day. When they arrived at Gibeah, a procession of prophets met him. The Spirit of God came upon him in power, and he joined in their prophesying. So just as Samuel had said, those signs happened. Okay? And here we see that Saul then prophesies with the prophets coming out of Gibeah. Some people saw him who knew him. And verse 11, when all those who had formerly known him saw him prophesying with the prophets, they asked each other, what is this that's happened to the son of Kish? Is Saul among the prophets? So they wondered, what's the deal with Saul? What's happened to him? Something's different about him. Is he now a prophet? What's going on? Did Saul let other people know what had happened, that Samuel had come to him, had anointed him, and told him that he was chosen to be king? We're going on, verse 14. Now, Saul's uncle had asked him and his servant, where have you been? Looking for donkeys, he said. But when we saw that they weren't to be found, we went to Samuel. Saul's uncle said, oh, well, tell me what Samuel said to you. Saul replied, well, he assured us that the donkeys had been found. But he didn't tell his uncle that Samuel had said about his kingship. Okay, so he kept it to himself, and he didn't share that with anyone else. And then we have, in chapter 10, that Samuel gathers the people at Mizpah again. Okay, we saw that earlier. And so Mizpah kind of becomes a national gathering place. It's kind of in the center of the nation, and people would come together and meet. The leaders would come together. So Samuel gathers them together again at Mizpah. And why? Verse 17. Samuel summoned the people of Israel to Yahweh at Mizpah and said to them, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought Israel up out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the power of Egypt and all the kingdoms that oppressed you. But you've now rejected your God, and who saves you out of all your calamities and distresses, and you've said, no, set a king over us. So now, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and clans. So he gathered them at Mizpah and said, okay, you've rejected God and said that he's not a good enough king for you. You want your own king. So God's going to give you a king. So come to Mizpah and God will choose a king for you. Okay? So how does he show that this... He already knows who the king is Saul. How does he show the people that this king was chosen by God, not by Samuel? Going on. When Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. Okay, so he threw lots. And lots is kind of like throwing dice. And as he throws lots, the way that they turn up is in God's control. And so that is showing that God has made this choice. So the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. Then he brought forward the tribe of Benjamin, clan by clan, and Matri's clan was chosen. Finally, Saul, the son of Kish, was chosen. But when they looked for him, he was not to be found. So he drew the lots for the tribe, for the clan, for the family, and eventually settled on the man and said, okay, Saul is the one. So how eager was Saul to be presented as the first king of Israel? We'll pick back up again at the end of verse 21. It says, but when they looked for Saul, he was not to be found. So they inquired further of the Lord, has the man come here yet? And the Lord said, yeah, he's hidden himself among the baggage. So they ran and they brought him out. And as he stood among the people, he was a head taller than any of the others. Okay. So how eager was Saul to be the first king of Israel? He wasn't. He was hesitant. He was reluctant. He didn't feel qualified. He felt inadequate to be the first king of Israel. He felt inadequate to be a king. Okay? Was this feeling of inadequacy rare for those chosen by God? There's some great leaders in the Bible. And God raised up some great leaders. He prepared them for their ministries and for their work. Did any of them experience inadequacies? Well, let's just look at a few of them. Well, in Exodus 3, when God called Moses... we'll just take a look, for example, at verse 11. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? So Moses felt inadequate for the job. In fact, he gave five excuses, and you've got those verses there you can look at, five reasons why he was the wrong guy for the job. Okay? In the book of Judges, when we looked at the book of Judges, in chapter 6, verse 15, when God called Gideon, here we see the same sort of thing that Saul said. But Lord, Gideon asked, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family. So Gideon felt inadequate. Let's go forward. Jeremiah, the first verse of first chapter of Jeremiah, verse 6, after Jeremiah is called, he says, oh, sovereign Lord, I said, I don't know how to speak. I'm only a child. Okay, I'm too young for this job. I'm not a spokesman. I can't speak. In fact, that was one of the excuses that Moses had given. Luke 5, verse 8, we see another example. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, go away from me, Lord. I'm a sinful man. So Peter felt inadequate to even be around Jesus, much less be the rock upon whose confession that Jesus would build his church, and the leader of the apostles. Okay, and then one other example we'll look at is in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 8. And this is Paul speaking. And he says, although I am less than the least of all God's people, this grace was given to me to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ. So even Paul, the great missionary, the greatest missionary that we've seen, said that he was less than the least of all of God's people. So all of these great leaders of faith, all of these people, Moses, Gideon, Jeremiah, Peter, Paul, and there's other examples in here as well, they all felt inadequate to fulfill the calling that God had called them to. But we look back at what happened and we see that they did a great job. How were they able to become great leaders of God's people even though they were inadequate when they were called? Exodus chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. The Lord said to him, to Moses, who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now, go. I will help you speak and I will teach you what to say. So how were they able to become great leaders? By God. God was with them. God worked through them. They let God work through them. Okay, God told them what to do. God told them what to say. God led them, and they lived in a relationship with God so that they could follow God's lead. They could recognize God's direction. They could let God work through them instead of trying to do it on their own. So what about us? What should we remember when we feel inadequate to do the work that God's called us to do? What should we remember when we feel inadequate to share our faith like God has called us to do? 1 Corinthians 2, verse 13 says, this is what we speak, not in words taught us by human wisdom, but in words taught by the Spirit, expressing spiritual truths in spiritual words. Okay? So we don't come up with the words. God does. God gives us the words. God tells us what to say. So we should remember that God will give us the words that we need when we're doing His work, when we're sharing His faith. What should we remember when we feel inadequate to do the work that God has for us to do? 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9. This is Paul talking about his weaknesses, and he said, but God said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, my power is made perfect in weakness. So when we feel that the job is too big for us to do, that we can't handle it, that we are too inadequate to do the job, that's perfect. That's exactly what God needs. He needs us to depend on Him. If we're going to do His work and do it successfully, it's not us who's going to be doing the work. It's God who's going to be doing the work through us. So He needs us to depend on Him, to rely on Him, to let Him work in our lives to do His work. So Saul's response here of inadequacy, that's on track. Saul, if you're not adequate, if you don't feel capable of doing this job, that's perfect, because the only way you're going to do the job then, and you're going to do it right, is by letting God work through you and letting God be the king through you. Okay? So, Saul was then presented to the people as the king. Did the people accept Saul as their new king? Back to chapter 10, verse 24 and verse 27. Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see the man that God has chosen? There's no one like him among all the people." And then the people shouted, "Long live the king." But there were some troublemakers who said, "How can this fellow save us?" They despised him and brought him no gifts. But Saul kept silent. So the bulk of the people supported Saul. The bulk of the people said, "Long live the king. Long live the king that God has chosen for us." But there were some troublemakers who opposed him, who didn't support Saul. There were some troublemakers who opposed him, who didn't support Saul, who said, "Hey, how can this guy save us?" They didn't trust him, and they were not expecting this to last very long, and who knows what they might do. Okay, what did Saul do after this momentous historic event? Well, we'll go backwards, verse 25. Samuel explained to the people the regulations of the kingship. He wrote them down on a scroll and deposited it before the Lord. Then Samuel dismissed the people, each to his own home. And Saul also went to his home in Gibeah, accompanied by valiant men whose hearts God had touched. So what did Saul do after being crowned king of all of Israel? He went home. He went back home to Gibeah, and we'll see as we go on, he went back to his old ways. He went back to his old job of working in the fields and working for doing stuff for his dad, that kind of thing. He didn't take his calling it to be king of Israel seriously. And he didn't fulfill the calling that had been given him. But eventually something happened. Something happened that prompted him and gave the occasion for Saul to begin acting as a king. We see that in chapter 11. Nahash the Ammonite went up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to him, "Make a treaty with us and we'll be subject to you." But Nahash the Ammonite replied, "I'll make a treaty with you on the condition that I gouge out the right eye of every one of you and so bring disgrace on all Israel." The elders of Jabesh said to him, "Well, give us 7 days so we can send messengers throughout Israel. If no one comes to rescue us, then we'll surrender to you." Okay? So the Ammonites attacked Jabesh-Gilead. Jabesh-Gilead was a city on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Okay? Saul's in Gibeah on the western side. But Jabesh-Gilead is part of Israel. And so the Ammonites attack Jabesh-Gilead. So they attack and they say that, "We're going to gouge out the right eye of every one of you and bring disgrace on Israel and show you that we're more powerful than you." And Jabesh asked for 7 days. So they asked for 7 days. How does Saul then learn of this attack going on? When the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and reported these terms to the people, they all wept aloud. Just then Saul was returning from the fields behind his oxen. So you see what Saul is doing. He's working out in the fields. And he asked, "What's wrong with the people? Why are they weeping?" Well, then they repeated to him what the men of Jabesh had said. Okay. So he heard from messengers after coming in from working in the fields. So you see that he had not taken his kingship seriously. But now there's a threat to the nation. How does he respond? Does he act like a king now? Going on. When Saul heard their words, the Spirit of God came upon him in power and he burned with anger. Okay, so here you see God gets involved and God helps him start acting like a king. He took a pair of oxen, cut them into pieces, and sent the pieces by messengers throughout Israel, proclaiming, "This is what will be done to the oxen of anyone who does not follow Saul and Samuel." Then the terror of God fell upon the people, and they turned out as one man. When Saul mustered them at Bezek, the men of Israel numbered 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. So he cut apart these oxen, sent them throughout Israel to get people's attention and to get them to come and commit soldiers to an army that would go and attack the Ammonites at Jabesh-Gilead. And 330 Israelites came out and joined him there. What did Saul then do with the army that God had brought to him? Verse 11, the next day Saul separated his men into three divisions. During the last watch of the night, they broke into the camp of the Ammonites and slaughtered them until the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. So they slaughtered the Ammonites and rescued the people of Jabesh-Gilead. And so now we had this victory. Saul had proven that he can be king, that he can be a leader. He had proven his leadership. Now that he had, remember there were some troublemakers. There were some who had opposed him. When someone comes into power, You take a look at the nations around, and when there's a coup and someone decides he's king and gets rid of the other kings or the other leaders of that country, a common approach is to kill off all that leader's supporters so that you don't have any opposition. So is that what Saul did here with the people who had opposed him when he was appointed king? Going on, verse 12, the people then said to Samuel, "Who was it then that asked, 'Shall Saul reign over us?' Bring these men to us and we'll put them to death." But Saul said, "No one's going to be put to death today, for this day the Lord rescued Israel." Okay, so he forgave them. So you see, at the very beginning of his job as king, some faithfulness. Okay, he responds when there's this threat. He gives forgiveness here. He prophesies with the prophets at Gibeah. So here he's got this great start into becoming a king. How did Israel celebrate this great victory? Going on. Then Samuel said to the people, "Come, let's go to Gilgal and there reaffirm the kingship." So all the people went to Gilgal and confirmed Saul as king in the presence of the Lord. There they sacrificed fellowship offerings before the Lord, and Saul and all the Israelites held a great celebration. So they went to Gilgal and they all together confirmed Saul as king. They had agreed when he was appointed, but now he's proven himself. And now we're going to confirm that we will be subject to him, that we will pay attention to him, we will obey him, we will follow his lead. Okay? And now, where was Gilgal? Gilgal is where, if you remember back in Joshua chapter 4, when the Israelites crossed the Jordan River and first came into the mainland of Israel, of the Promised Land, Joshua had 12 stones taken out of the Jordan River and stood up as a memorial to remind people that of what God had done for them. That's where Gilgal is. And so that's where Samuel brought these people, and they confirmed Saul's kingship at this historic place for Israel. One last note, how old was Saul when he became king? If we go a couple chapters further, chapter 13, it says that Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel for 42 years. Okay? And then next week we'll continue on with the additional stories of Saul. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the story of Saul becoming king. We thank you for seeing that oftentimes we may ask for things like the Israelites asked for a king that may or may not be in our best interest, and that you're in control. And sometimes you let us have what we ask for, even though it may be teaching us a lesson. And we thank you for that. Help us to see those lessons that you teach us and learn from them. We thank you for seeing how Saul started out as faithful and humble, that he was a man that had great opportunity and great potential ahead of him to be your servant as king, to lead your people Israel. We have opportunities. We have potential that you've given us. You've given us spiritual gifts that we can do your work. Help us to put those into practice and help us to be the people, the leaders, the parts of your body that you've called us to be, so that your body can be complete and do your work in this world. We pray this in the name of the head of this body, Jesus Christ. Amen.